Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome. Okay, everybody, welcome back to One Broken Mom. I have back with me a guest that everybody is familiar with, and she's one of our favorite episodes. We've done a couple of episodes together. It's Wendy Beharry, and Wendy is the founder and the director of the Cognitive Therapy Center of New Jersey and the Schema Therapy Institutes of New Jersey, New York, and D.C. She has been training professionals and supervising psychotherapists for more than 20 years in this field of schema therapy, but you all know her as the author of Disarming the Narcissist, Surviving and Thriving with the Self-Absorbed. So welcome back, Wendy.
Thank you, Ami. I'm so happy to be back with you. Thanks for having me.
I am too. So how's it been since the last time we talked? It's been at least a couple of months since we were back on here talking about our favorite, not favorite subject of narcissism and narcissistic relationships.
It's been, you know, it's busy. And in this particular specialty area, it's a constant flow of very important questions and unfortunate suffering that people are dealing with when you're dealing with someone with issues of narcissism. So I continue to be incredibly busy. And I'm excited to talk about this topic because this one is also just so painfully meaningful to so many people out there who are dealing with hypersexuality and the trauma of being betrayed.
Yeah. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, and I'm looking forward to this too in that way, because I think that there's a lot of elements and aspects of those relationships that a lot of people are unfamiliar with, especially on the outside. And I don't think that a lot of people are able to talk about that part of their narcissistic abusive relationship because it's embarrassing. It's taboo. I mean, how do you talk about, you know, all the kind of the darker secrets that go on? It's sometimes easier to talk about being hit by another person than it is to be talking about the omnipresence of, you know, a cheating partner in your life and having to just be combated with that on a, you know, on a regular basis. Yeah. And so I think this will be pretty eye-opening for a lot of folks that are, again, that don't, you know, thank God haven't experienced, you know, a relationship like this, but then also for those who have, to understand, you know, there's some real wounds in healing that have to come from this process here. And so I'm grateful that you're here to talk about this. Now I want to dial back to a word, that I know for myself, I had to get comfortable with and using it, you know, and recognizing it. And that's the word abuse. And I believe, to me, in my opinion, it was one of the first hurdles that had to be cleared so that for any person, including myself, could really start to look at their own situation in a way that would really help identify what was really happening, so that there's this development of greater self-awareness and reflectiveness, and so that there's an opportunity to look for the places that need to be healing and need to be unpacked. And what I mean by all this is that many people who have a trauma history, as I'm sure you know from working with so many folks, to one degree or another, a little bit of trauma, a whole lot of trauma, have a hard time looking at circumstances and seeing it sometimes as abusive, because we literally have grown up with thinking that some of these behaviors are just par for the course.
Right.
Because it's unfortunately not all that different from what we've pretty much experienced in one form or another, you know, throughout our lives. And so I think that through my own experience, what was startling was how when you're in a relationship with a real manipulator, the normal toxicity, again, that our, you know, our trauma survivors are used to dealing with, grew into abuse, but it did it slowly. like the frog in a pot of water, and has no idea the temperature is rising until it's too late and it's cooked. And that even when you look back and you have to call it for what it was, just so that you can actually grow from the experience, not necessarily be able to point a finger and say that that person is an abuser, but to actually say, like, this moved, you know, my relationship shifted. It changed from something that was unhealthy to begin with at best into an abusive situation. And I have to acknowledge that. I have to be okay with that word. I needed to sit with it and be able to use it, neutralize it, desensitize it so that it could turn into something I could take action, you know, with and stuff like that. And so how would you define abuse so that other people might be able to use that definition looking back at what they're going through or what they've already been through with somebody else?
Yeah. It's such an important term, and it has a variety of definitions, but I think central to the core in the issue of abuse is when we have been violated. You know, it's a violation. It's an act against our will, against our safety, against our soul in many cases. And so, you know, abuse is an extraordinary event, meaning that, you know, we don't walk around all day expecting people to physically violate us, to sexually or emotionally or mentally or verbally, you know, violate us, you know, come up against us and validate who we are. And yet it can happen in the most, what's supposed to be the most tender, precious, wonderful relationship. Our primary love relationship is the place where we'll find it sometimes comes to nest, sadly enough. And if you've suffered this in your early life as a child, as you said so beautifully just now, Emmy, that it can feel almost just so familiar that you don't recognize it as, you know, a bell ringing or a red flag. And yet it's not okay. You know, it is extraordinary. That's what we think of when we think of trauma. We think of something that's outside of the ordinary. That's why I said we don't have this expectation in our day-to-day life. Or maybe some people do because they've grown up with it. So they just expect that people are going to treat them badly because it's all they've known. And how sad, right? That you carry this burden of grief and pain and now anticipation that this is the way the world works. But for those who are sort of met with it, and what we're going to get into when we talk about hypersexuality and betrayal trauma, you know, you're met with it and it feels like the rug just got ripped out from under you again. This is trauma. It's just extraordinary. The brain can't easily process why this is happening. What does this mean? What does it mean about me? Unless you've had the experience, you've already learned that it's my fault. You know, so all too often, especially women who have been the subjects or the victims of abuse will feel, well, you know, I provoked it and, you know, I could have done this a little better. I could have looked a little better. I could have been smarter. I could have been more charitable. There's always something they could have done more of. And so when you're owning your own abuse, you're already set up to A, let the other person off the hook, and B, submit to that sense of powerlessness that may have been true when you truly were a very vulnerable child and powerless. Mm-hmm. So it's a tough word to define. I mean, and again, when we talk about narcissism, not all narcissists are in that, you know, they're not aggressive abusers, but, you know, they all tend, even without intention many times, to be hurtful. And it can, in many cases, border on what we would call abuse because it is so invalidating, so violating of one's rights to feel safe and to feel loved and to feel accepted, to feel respected even at the most basic level.
Right, right. Now, I think sometimes also I wonder if there's this invalidation of it because some people don't do it consciously. Some people don't, you know, there are abusers that know that what they're doing is they're pushing a button right now and they're going to get something they want out of it. And they have already consciously decided that they don't really care how you feel or how it makes you feel or whatever. There's an end result that they're looking for, which is what we see a narcissistic relationship or a relationship with somebody that may be more psychopathic or whatever. There's just that lack of that empathy in there. But does it change if the other person doesn't think that what they're doing is abusive? You know, and I mean, for example, like with financial and economic abuse, which is something that I've, you know, I've dealt with too, that I didn't even think about as an abuse form, right? But then after you go back and you're like, well, yeah, of course it was another point of control. It was another point of devaluing me. It was another point of demeaning me. It was a way of, you know, taking resources from me so that they could have resources and to keep me powerless to do anything about it. But we have society and we have culture that women typically hand over financial responsibilities to a partner, and partners can then suddenly become more controlling when they have that power in their hands. And I guess it's like, you know, it is a borderline, and they can't, I mean, I would say that some people do become abusive with it. You know, they become abusive with that control and that power. They second guess you, they question you, they, you know, demand that you do certain things and not certain things, but nobody would sit there and the two people in that person who's doing that control would say, well, this isn't abusive. This is an understanding. Our relationship has this understanding that I get to make all these choices and things, even if the other person on the other end is feeling demeaned and controlled and manipulated by it. Does that change how we view that word? Because I think people also don't want to label their situation as abusive because they don't want to put the label abuser onto another person. And so they just kind of dial back and dismiss it altogether.
Yeah, and we can forget about labeling the person an abuser and really look at the activity, the actions, the behaviors, the gestures. You used all of the words that capture it perfectly, which is, I mean, let's just think about this. What is abuse? Well, there's a lack of consent when abuse is happening. It's, again, it's taking away your will. It is to control. It is about rendering someone else in a position of compliance, surrender, powerless, whether it's the exploitation, which is part of abuse, of power, of money, of custody of children, whatever it might be. It's abusive when it is demeaning to one's sense of self, when it is diminishing and dismissive. I mean, we can use all kinds of words to describe what is also a form of abuse, which means that you're taking something and you're exploiting it for the sake of your own good, regardless of the impact on the other. It doesn't have to be a black eye. You know, people will say, well, it's not abusive. I didn't get pushed down the stairs or anything. Okay, but, you know, you have no rights. You have lost all your power. You are completely resonating with this idea that this is your fault and you should be punished. And this is a complete distortion of truth that you've been made to feel. You know, when we think about gaslighting, I mean, narcissists, again, they will do anything they can to protect their ego. It's not like the psychopath or the sociopath who actually gets some pleasure out of making you suffer. Narcissists don't necessarily take pleasure in making you suffer. They take pleasure in getting what they want and protecting their ego. And if that means crushing you to make that happen, well, so be it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, that just made my skin crawl right there. So now the topic at hand, which is hypersexualization, which is a word that I don't think a lot of people are familiar with. How does hypersexualization, you know, what is it and how does it fit into this picture of a relationship with a narcissist?
It is not uncommon to find that, and I'm going to talk mostly about men because this is where we're most likely to see it occur. It's a much smaller percentage when we think about women, but narcissistic men, and this won't be surprising when we go back and I'll remind everyone of things I've said before about narcissism, that these men tend towards a hypersexual, meaning a highly sexual, maybe outside of the ordinary, where they're highly preoccupied with sexual gratification, sexual stimulation, being in states of arousal, finding them, I don't want to use the word addicted because that carries lots of different meaning attached to it, but some people will use sexually addicted. A strong sexual preoccupation. They will spend hours in pornography looking at porn sites. They will sometimes escalate from there to chat rooms and cyber sex, to prostitutes, to real people in the world. And it's, again, what I meant before was it's not surprising because for the narcissist, one of the hardest things for them to achieve in their interpersonal relationships is intimacy. They may be top performers when it comes to what they do, but when it comes to being connected, this is a challenge, this is a struggle. I'm not talking about the charm and the heroics and the sweetness and courtship and making their way, making the pitch and making the sale. I'm talking about real intimacy, vulnerability, openness, looking at you, knowing themselves, that shared connection. It's so tough for them. They're so unskilled, unprepared, and actually so, in many ways, they devalue it because they don't see it as having, you know, there's nothing monetary, there's nothing tangible in intimacy. And so it would make sense that we'd find them on porn sites or find them, you know, paying prostitutes, because you don't have to be intimate. You don't have to give anything. It's all get, no give. Maybe some dollars you have to give if you're buying prostitutes, but there's no give. So it's all about you all the time, whenever you want, right at your fingertips, especially in this day and age, you can have access. And for them, remember, when they are not in the face of an audience who's loving them, adoring them, appreciating them, and they're not distracted with some game they're playing or some maybe work or something else that has their attention, they're lonely people who have deep insecurities, and they need to find distraction. And many will find distraction in sex. Mm-hmm. But they won't look for sex in that romantic, intimate way. They will look for sex in this kind of quick and easy, on my terms, when I want it, with no strings attached. They will also have affairs. But let's face it, what are affairs anyway, right? They're sort of circumscribed situations that don't reflect real life. It's secret, it's taboo, it's, you know, it's doing something outside of the boundaries, it's getting away with it, and it's highly sexually charged for the most part. So even there, you're not necessarily talking, I mean, in rare cases, it might turn into a love relationship, but that's really rare with a narcissist. So it's not surprising to us when we think about their makeup, which is so heavily weighted on performance. And here's the interesting irony, while I'm saying the word performance, so I don't forget this, that sex is performance, right? Mm-hmm. But performance in a true, intimate, loving relationship means meeting the needs of the other partner. So there's actually a burden for the narcissist to be a good lover, to be a good performer. And they're always rating themselves, you know, trying to rate themselves in that situation. They don't have to do that when you're looking at a screen. Or you're paying someone for services who's going to tell you you're the super stud man. So it's just comes so easily and so naturally, feels like the right fit. And what's the big deal anyway, Wendy? This is what, you know, guys do. I mean, get over it. This is not a big deal. I mean, so what? So it's a little thrill seeking. You know, I'm a thrill seeker. I like adventure. It's not really hurting anybody. Then why are you doing it in secret? Why is it not open on the table? You know, why are you not sharing this in your relationship? Why do you do it discreetly? Because she's like you, you know, she'll just go kind of, she's so sensitive to all of this and, you know, she'll feel so, you know, put off by it. Yeah, well, there's reasons for that. And sometimes I even go further into little psychoeducation on what they're actually enjoying when they're getting aroused by, you know, prostitutes and pornography stars. And talk to them a little bit about, you know, the actors in these situations and where they come from and the abuse that they have suffered as they play these roles. It's really tough stuff, you know, and it's so painful to partners and it's so damaging to families. And it's damaging to them too, because the truth is, and there is some data on this, when they get immersed in this hypersexual mode, and then they try to come out of it, as many will do in their rehabilitation. As they come out of it, sexual performance can become problematic thereafter, because what they've been looking at, what they've been engaged in, what they've been fantasizing about while they are in this situation is not real life relationships. And so real life relationships become not arousing enough. They can't perform. They'll have sexual problems as a result of that, sexual dysfunction, perhaps. And then their performance and their ego is even more shattered because now they can't engage. It takes a lot of work. It's not impossible. It takes really, really good hard therapy to try to bypass these obstacles once they make a commitment to do so. But so hurtful in the process to partners who are on the receiving end of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so many things going through my head while you were talking about all that stuff, because, you know, I've seen all of those things. I've seen the decline in the performance. I've seen the the front end of all of it, which it you know, when you look back, you're like, wow, this all felt like it was a game in the beginning, right? The whole, I'm going to wow you in every way possible. And, you know, I know for myself, I didn't see that, unfortunately, because it's provocative and exciting. And like I said, this is an adult show, and I'm not ashamed of the fact that I am a woman and I have had sex at least twice. I got two kids. but the reality is that there is something incredibly stimulating and erotic about a person at the beginning, especially if you as a person are desiring some intensity, because you've got your own low points in there. And I know we've talked about this before, you know, when you find yourself attracted, some of us, into and towards the, you know, the light, like a moth, you know, to the narcissist, a lot of that's engaging. And sex is primal, and it is easy to be lured into the relationship with somebody, especially if in the beginning they seem to be very much in tune with what you want. But then you look back and you realize it was all really about them and them wanting to conquest, and yes, then repeat that over and over again. And you're right. Once you're in the relationship with them, they no longer get that fill from that. There's, you know, there's no mutuality in the sexual relationship anymore. It's, you know, almost maintenance, right? And so they go back out and they find themselves over and over again. And in this day and age, it's much easier than prostitutes. All you need to do is get yourself like three or four different dating apps, and you can find a bunch of willing partners, you know, out there, and even other ones that want to have their own, you know, affairs. And so there's a whole lot of free available people, you know, for somebody to actually engage in. And I remember, you know, having to deal with this a lot, and it was hard. It was a third wheel in the relationship of, you know, and the sick feeling of, is he cheating on me? Was he really where he said he was supposed to be, you know, or was he out messing around with somebody else? And, you know, the denials and the, no, you're crazy, the gaslighting, like, no, I was doing none of that. None of that was actually happening. And then you find out later that it was all, you know, it was all true. Are all narcissists though like this? I know you talked about men versus women, but, you know, do all narcissists have this predilection towards hypersexualization, or is it just, is it a smaller number? I mean, what does it look like in narcissists?
I would venture to guess, though I don't know the actual statistic on this, but I would venture to guess that it's a relatively high number. And the reason why is based in the issue of entitlement. You know, not all people who have sexual addictions or hypersexuality are necessarily narcissistic. Some may come from other backgrounds where they've been abused, and there's a whole different story behind, you know, gravitating towards a promiscuous lifestyle after abuse. But narcissists, again, it all sort of comes down to this idea of, you know, they are thrill seekers. So when they're looking for ways to distract themselves from pain, insecurity, loneliness, shame, emptiness, boredom, it's usually with something that's exciting, something competitive. And sex falls into this category of arousal and stimulation. And so many of them are apt to, you know, it matters to partners. It starts with pornography. And I can't tell you how many partners have said to me, well, you know, it's just porn, so he doesn't feel that's cheating. Well, you know, you weren't clued in. There's a whole world of fantasy going on. And it's not just happening occasionally. It's happening pretty incessantly, because they do anything on a small level. Everything is fairly excessive and extreme when it comes to narcissists. And the problem is the damage that it then creates in the relationship, the expectation and the sense of entitlement. So some of the men I've worked with who have erectile dysfunction issues, or they have partial impotency issues, you know, they'll just cut off sex completely with their partner and turn to their screen and become obsessively involved in the pornography on the screen. The entitlement is, I'm entitled to do this, and I'm entitled to not meet your needs, and you should be okay with that, because, you know, I can't perform, so you should be okay with that. Well, how about a urologist? How about getting some help? How about we look into, if this is a psychological issue, let's rule out the medical issue. They're not going to do that. There's so much shame involved in that. And those that will are those that are perhaps more motivated to look for outside fix. So they might look for a doc who can give them the Cialis or the Viagra, something that can help overcome the issue so that they can look for that outside fix. They can feel that sense of masculinity again. I don't say this with disdain. I know there's a suffering side, even for the narcissistic man that I treat who's going through this. What's difficult is the degree of entitlement that they feel to do as they please, that it shouldn't matter, and that their partner should just be okay with that. Mm-hmm. That's what's always so incredibly amazing to me, and that's what differentiates them from anyone else who may have any predilections towards hypersexuality.
Mm-hmm. I just took a deep breath. I feel that pain in my chest, or not a pain in my chest. I'm not having a heart attack or anything like that, but I'm feeling that, you know, the somatic experience right here of that in my chest of the, yeah, definitely the, you just need to deal with it. It's just the way that it is. These are the rules, you know, tough. You don't like it, you know, move on or whatever, you know, whatever it is. Yeah. I'm gonna take a pause right there. So I feel like I want to ask a follow-up question, and you and I talked off air, and I've got to kind of watch what I say right now because of some other things that are going on in my life. So I'm going to ask this question. This is a safe one.
Okay.
Is this different than sex addiction? And I know you talked about it a little bit just a few moments ago, that there are different reasons why people become sex addicts or love addicts or drug addicts or anything like that. Because this feels like an addiction, right? It feels like there's, you know, this entitlement or the sense of filling up your empty emotional fuel tank has to come from the conquest of, you know, can I get this woman on Tinder to sleep with me? And can I do it 5 times this week? And can I hide it from my partner? And can I, you know, all of that stuff feels like there's a, and I will admit too, I'm a dopamine type seeking person. Mm-hmm. I like the challenge. I love competition. That's just the way my wiring and everything came together. So can I see the competition that there's involved in this hypersexualization? Yes, I can totally, you know, I can totally see that. But is that different than somebody who has a sex addiction? We have different things at play here.
Yeah. I mean, it can be. I mean, it's not always about the sex itself. So the difference is that those who have what we might think of as the more bona fide sex addiction, it really is about the sex. Whereas with the narcissist, it's not always about the sex, it's about the game. And it's about the fantasy. And it's about, I mean, those that will sit in front of the screen for hours and just fantasize about being, you know, the man on the screen or the guy with the biggest organ. I mean, it's just there's a lot of fantasy that goes into play. So sex tends to be the conduit, you know, it's the common denominator in their fantasy, but it's not always about sex itself or them having sex, because remember, there's a lot of performance. There's a great demand for performance within them, performance of all kinds, but there's also great inhibition, especially when they reach certain ages when it comes to sexual performance. And the bigger problem for them, again, comes back to this idea that they just have so much trouble integrating it with intimacy. You know, being able to integrate this life with the life of intimacy. There's also a lot of overlap. So your question is important because, you know, we have to recognize that with many of these syndromes, if you will, there's so much overlap. There are those who are just, you know, completely sexually preoccupied, sexually addicted, and it's about sex. It's about the orgasm. It's about the actual experience. Whereas for others, it's just sex is the context that they live in. It's the competition. It's the game. It's the fantasy. It's the what if. It's the... And also some of the, and the orgasm as well. So it's a little bit of everything.
You know, you've mentioned the intimacy a few times here, and I do want to talk about that, because I do know that we do tend to, and I want to say this as a generalization, some people have really healthy levels of understanding the differences between the forms of intimacy. But intimacy is sometimes a word that we do equate with a sexual relationship, you know, the of getting past the fear of being naked in front of another person, of being vulnerable with that person in bed, and, you know, maybe even sharing with them fantasies and things like that you have from a sexual experience. And so it can feel like when you have a sexual relationship with another person that you truly have an intimate relationship with a person, and that the not understanding that the lack of an emotional connection in there is an important, you know, missing piece or a missing puzzle in there. Because I can say having a powerfully, intense, you know, and we've talked, this has been a word that, you know, some people confuse intimacy with intensity, right? And so when you're driven for that intensity level and you've got this intensely sexual relationship with another person, it does kind of wash away the fact that there's missing parts, you know, on that emotional connection in there as well. But I know coming through a relationship like that and then looking back in my rearview mirror going, wow, there really wasn't a lot of intimate connection from an emotional standpoint. You know, I found that there were times of wanting to have conversations and having them just pushed away, avoided, or noticing that my partner at that time didn't even have a vocabulary, to even have the conversation. So it just was like a non-starter most of the time. Go ahead.
Sorry. I'm thinking as you're describing it again, I mean, it just brings up a very important word that is so akin to understanding narcissism. It's the lack of reciprocity. So when we think of a really intimate relationship, there's a give and a take, right? I'm sharing my intimate, vulnerable self with you emotionally, mentally, physically, and you're sharing yours with me. If we are partners, this is what is happening in the relationship. It's reciprocity. But when you're living with a narcissist, there's little to no reciprocity. It's, you know, you're giving and you're not getting. And then you stop giving because you're not getting. And then it becomes almost a stalemate, you know, where you're just in these disenfranchised camps where you can't connect. And the narcissist, but we have sex. Yes, there's sex. And is your partner satisfied? Well, she should be. But is she? Do you talk about it? Do you investigate? Are you asking questions? Are you listening to the answers? You know, I mean, this is what comes up in the treatment room. And very often, no, that's not what's going on. There's no reciprocity.
Right. Right. Yeah, it definitely. And, you know, and again, this goes back to what I said at the beginning of the thing. You know, some people, it takes a while to recognize that lack thereof, because if you grew up again in situations where there was no reciprocity in your own caregiver, family and connections in your relationships, that just feels like it's par for the course. You know, it really is. And it's really, you know, once you get into and you meet other people that know how to return that back to you, you begin to recognize the absence of it, you know, in a relationship. Yes. But you're right. Like even if they can satisfy you sexually, that doesn't make up for the fact that you can't sit there and have that conversation with them about emotions and feelings and sharing something with them. And I know in some experiences too, it gets into the abuse part that when you are vulnerable with them, you do share something about yourself. You admit to, and you know, something that you're trying to hold your own self accountable to, they turn around and they use that as a weapon against you. Like it becomes a weaponized, instead of them being able to meet you to share something of themselves, they manage to, again, assert and move themselves up above you. Their superiority comes out, and they, you know, then further confirm that yes, you are lesser than they are, and yes, you are the one that needs therapy, not them, and you know, whatever the direction may go in the conversation. So
yeah, and there's what happens in the situation where there is this acting outside of the relationship, where the narcissist is involved in sexual experiences, I'm going to call them, whether they're live, real, online, they're involved in this whole other sexual world. What's happening there in the relationship is that A, they feel entitled to it, even though B, it's outside of your consent. So it's not like the couple has engaged. I mean, if you have, fine, then you're probably not listening to this, but if it's happening outside of your consent, it means it has not been discussed. You have not been informed. So you're working without informed consent. And a personal, loving relationship is based on informed consent. I know why I'm choosing you. I know who you are. I know what we are about. I know our contractual agreement in this relationship about fidelity, monogamy, whatever it might be. And if that's what you're living with, you're living and choosing this person based on that knowledge, and they're outside, you know, violating that contract, that's abusive. Mm-hmm.
Indeed it is. Is the person who does this, you know, you've talked about porn a lot, and then I can relate my personal experiences with actual outside of the house, sleeping with other people, infidelity. So it feels like that's a range from the person who fantasizes about doing it and maybe never actually goes and sleeps around with other people, to the person who, you know, there's very little porn because they're going out and actually doing it live and everything in between. Where does that spectrum look like in terms of the narcissists that are dealing with it? Do a lot of them tend to be over here in the camp of never acting on it, or are a bunch of more, is this a bell curve where a few are here and a few are out here? For people that are listening, I'm so sorry, you're not seeing my hands, but one end of the bell curve may be just watching porn. The other end of the bell curve is, you know, hooking up with a different woman every 1 to 2 weeks, and then something in between. Where does that look like in that spectrum of where people tend to fall along on that bell curve?
I think with narcissists, you'll find gradual escalations, you know, where it may start with pornography and then escalate to like a chat room and then a real person. Although there are some who will just dive right into real, you know, people and bypass the other forms of sexual stimulation. Most of the men I've worked with are in a little bit of both, you know, so even if they are sleeping with other women randomly, they're looking at porn in between. I think there's no better or worse or right or wrong. I think it's hurtful no matter what, because if it's happening without consent, it's violating the private reality of the relationship. What is the one thing that distinguishes our love relationships from any other relationship that we have, providing that, you know, that's not an open marriage contract? The one thing is that private reality, the private reality of our intimacy, our sexuality with that partner. That's what makes it different than every other relationship. There's probably other things too, but this is one that's, you know, pretty outstanding. And when that gets violated, the pain is very great. And narcissists can go, I mean, they're just not a one size fits all when it comes to this. So they can go from, you know, pornography moving into real random people, or they can start over here and then fill in the gaps when they're kind of bored and lonely with pornography, or maybe a cyber sex chat room, or as you mentioned, even some of the dating apps. Although on some of the dating apps, there may be more of a call to perform, you know, to perform and be really thoughtful about the other person's needs. Whereas you don't have to do that so much when, or not, you know, not be so thoughtful and really just have kind of a one-stop shop and then you move on to the next person. I mean, that's just classic of narcissists. Again, it's got to be all about them. Mm-hmm. And they can make it look like they're really being thoughtful of you, or you, meaning whoever it is out there that they're engaging with. They can make it look like they're being very thoughtful of you, but what they're really thinking about is, how am I doing? Mm-hmm. How am I doing? Am I good? Am I the best you ever had? Mm-hmm. That's what it all comes down to. It's not, what is it really like for you? And yes, we all take pleasure in knowing that we can pleasure someone else that we love, but we also want our loved one to feel pleasure just for their own sake, because we love them. Mm-hmm. This is the hard thing for narcissists to really grasp.
Yeah.
Very difficult for them to, again, be in your skin, mm-hmm. you know, walk in your shoes.
Right. Right. It's the act of doing it, because it just is mirroring back to them how good they are at it. They, you know, and I get it. And it feels nuanced. I've said this before. Sometimes when we're in this field and we're looking and examining so many things, there's such nuances, and that's what you want to start to be able to detect, is that sometimes the performance, although you're getting some satisfaction out of it, isn't because they actually are getting pleasure out of you feeling good. Like they're imparting that empathetic, you know, response to you. It's that you're letting them know how awesome they are. You know, I mean, that's what it is. Sorry. Now, before we go into describing betrayal trauma here, you did mention something, and I do want to tack onto this, is the concept of the open relationship. Yeah. And I do believe that even in an open relationship, there's still a contract, and that you can still cheat on your partner in an open relationship.
I think you're right. You're right. Absolutely.
Yeah. So betrayal trauma. So this is where we're coming into. So we've kind of moved through, and we've got a relationship here with a hypersexualized partner. What is this doing to us, you know, psychologically, when we are when we have this in our life and our, you know, our most intimate person that, you know, is supposed to be loving and is mutual with us is actually not. How does this, you know, what is this betrayal trauma that we're experiencing?
Some of the experts in trauma actually believe that this might be one of the worst forms of trauma. And here's why. When you suffer a trauma from a stranger who has assaulted you or a car accident or something, you know, again, think trauma, think extraordinary, something outside of our usual ordinary experiences, something that's hard for the brain to process, something that's hard to resolve, takes time to resolve or make sense of, and something that can tap into our deepest and darkest fears and early life experiences as well, or what we would call schemas in the therapy that I practice. When we think of betrayal trauma, okay, let me go back. Stranger trauma. You've suffered a terrible assault outside or a car accident. You come home to your partner. Your partner is your refuge. Your partner is your protector. Your partner puts their arms around you. Your partner journeys with you through this terrible process of grieving and making sense out of what's just happened to you and dealing with flashbacks and nightmares and fears and worries that may come after the trauma. But when the perpetrator of the trauma is your partner, you've lost your refuge. And not only that, if they're still in the house with you, you're going home to your perpetrator every day to face the person who has ripped away your sense of safety and security, who has taken you down a path to believe in one way, shape, or form that it's your fault that you're in this pain, that you've caused this, that you're not something enough. And you're constantly left with the fear, even though they may be sobbing and begging for forgiveness and promising it will never happen again. That can happen even with narcissists from time to time when they really see the consequences in front of them. But even then, you're never sure if it's really never going to happen again. You know, and with, again, without really good help, it may be hard to ever move past that. So betrayal trauma leaves you in this predicament where you've lost your safety. Now, you may have wonderful friends, and thank God if you do, because you're going to need them to get you through this. You may have your own therapist or good family that you can turn to. But if you're still going home to the perpetrator of your trauma, it's kind of like imagining what it would be like to, you know, go be home every night to someone who's assaulted you. Mm-hmm. Because it's a form of assault. This violation, this news, this secret, this privacy that has been invaded upon, and the lack of responsibility. So you get the deny, you're crazy, they try gaslighting, it didn't happen, you're making a big deal, that's not true, it's not real, where's the evidence? You present the evidence, then they get defensive, and in the defense they're blaming you. You know, well, what do you want from me? I mean, if you would lose weight, or if you would just take care of yourself, or if you would attend to me a little bit more, what do you want from me? This is what guys do. I'm a guy, okay? It's testosterone driven. You get all kinds of things. So, you know, deny, defend, demean. That's the way it flows. And here you are, you know, you're just, you know, your eyes are open. You've just been hit by a truck and you're living with a truck driver. Mm-hmm. That's betrayal trauma.
The fascinating thing about this, you know, from my experience was, you know, you get hit with that, right? You've just found out that your partner has violated your trust. And then instead of getting up, packing up your suitcase, giving them the middle finger and walking out the front door, you stay, mm-hmm. You know? And I think that that's one of those unbelievable situations for people that don't understand what, again, the schemas like you talk about, the past experiences, the priming, the grooming, the script writing that went on into the heads of some of us, that when in that moment, the weirdest thing happens, which is we become little kids again, and we start fighting to survive and to not lose the affection of the most important person in our life. You know, that that abandonment, that risk, you know, that rejection, fear comes up. And, you know, looking at all of this, it's like the betrayal activates something inside of us, you know, at a level, not everybody, I'm sure, but for some of us, that does get happened. And I've heard something about it, you know, the attachment system fires up, whatever your attachment. So if you were anxiously attached with your caregiver, once you sense the fact that they may leave you, your partner may leave you, and that they're rejecting you, instead of walking away from it, because this is a messed up situation, this person's unhealthy, he's emotionally unavailable, you know, whatever the real rational, you know, decisions are, you do almost the opposite. You dig in and you try to make something work. Am I wrong there? I mean, I know that's from my experience there, but, and I know that that's something that other people just look and can't see that that actually happens, but it's the weirdest thing I've ever experienced myself, was to not run, but to actually dig in deeper and try to make it work.
No, I think it's really amazing that you shared that, and really helpful information, because that's exactly what happens. I mean, for so many people who are living with betrayal trauma, so many women that I've talked to, mostly women, some men, but mostly women who I've talked to, who will say, I mean, some of them will say, you know, that in a very rational way, I have children to protect. Where am I going? So there may be concrete reasons that, you know, an exit is just doesn't feel feasible at this moment. But most will say, I just feel desperate. I have to make this work. Or they've bought into the idea because, again, it's got a link. It's got roots in their early experience that says, maybe I did cause this. Maybe I did create the conflict that led to the frustration, that led to the cheating, that led to all of this. You know, I am a little inhibited in sexually, so maybe it is my issue. Well, you know, I have been a little perimenopausal, so I've been somewhat depressed and my libido isn't really there, so maybe that's why. And again, all of this can track back to fears of abandonment, feelings of defectiveness, fears of being deprived and alone. It's a kind of buying in, and not easy to step out of. Or there's also the times when I'll hear someone say, you know, I'm going to make them pay, you know, so there's the commitment to punishment, which I get, but who wants to spend their life being a private eye and a punisher, right? Because you have to forfeit a lot of your own life to do that. So much of it is usually linked, though, as you said, Ami, to the schemas that are getting activated that come from early life experiences. The shame, the humiliation. How will I tell people? Where will I go? What are people going to think of me that I picked somebody like this, or that they did something like this, that they're going to look at me like I wasn't enough? And it's so sad, and it's so powerful, it's so potent, and it can really overthrow one system. And we have to be very quick not to judge people who do stay. You know, it's easy to say brava for the woman who packs her bag and walks out the door with her middle finger up, but, and that's fine too, but we can't judge the one who's struggling and trying to come to conclusion, or maybe wants to try to rehabilitate the relationship if it's possible to get help and make that happen, for sometimes some healthy reasons and sometimes some not so healthy reasons. But it is quite a struggle. So I'm glad you spoke about that.
Thank you. Like I said, you know, coming from this and living through a lot of this stuff, you know, shame is the first thing that you have to get over. Because, you know, like you said, it's really easy to fall back into self-loathing. I mean, in a heartbeat. And no matter how much therapy and how much work you do, if it's in there, sometimes it never goes away. All that you do is you learn how to just, you know, swim back up to the surface, you know, get some breath back into you and get back to shore when something like that overtakes you. And the shame that's around, tolerating too much, you know, the shame that people not being able to look and make the, you know, not understand your root decisions, especially when you don't understand your root decisions and why. And that's why I said, you know, if, you know, this type of a trauma does trigger you to go back in until you know that that's what you're doing. You drive yourself right back down into the depths of every terrible experience you had at the hand of mom or dad or whoever around you was making you feel like you were less than enough for them. And that desperate child voice in your head that's telling you, like, if I just keep working harder, they'll love me. If I keep working harder, they'll be happy with me. If I do this, they won't leave. Yes. You know, and so that real rejection and abandonment that some people feel, when somebody that you love does this to you, your instinct, that instant instinct is to try to do something to make them love you, not walk away and go away. Because what could you do? You couldn't do that as a kid.
Exactly.
You know, that was not an option for you as a child. And so it's not surprising that when this happens, that may be, you know, where your mind goes and stuff like that. So what will betrayal trauma do to a person in terms of how they view relationships after they've kind of been through that? I mean, I know where my fear is. My fear is, honestly, is falling victim to it all over again.
Sure.
You know? And so, you know, I've made choices. Everybody knows this. I made choices not to date for a while, but even then I still get where I've got spidey senses that make me hypersensitive to looking out for, you know, a lot of red flags that I dismissed before because I don't want to, you know, land myself in. And so I'm really, really cautious, super cautious with even wanting to go have a beer with a person right now, because I feel like I'm just not in the mood, you know, and I don't want to even venture into that. And I don't feel like that's always a healthy thing. Sometimes I feel like I'm a little bit, you know, I'm still hurting from all of this, you know?
And I think it's a bit of both. I think the hurting, still hurting from that makes sense. And being cautious is part of your healthy adult mode. You're not paranoid. And you're not totally avoidant, but making a deliberate decision that I'm going to be cautious and I'm going to be asking different questions and I'm going to be paying attention. I'm going to be trusting my instincts. I'm going to be careful to try to distinguish between past experience and what's happening right in front of me at this moment. I'm going to secure my most precious, fragile little self from once upon a time in a secure space so I can go out there and be my adult self and ask the hard questions and be honest about what matters to me and watch the reactions to that. And I'm going to take my time. You know, I mean, at its worst, betrayal trauma can leave people feeling, you know, when they do exit, being terribly avoidant and just expecting like this is just how the world works, period. And so they end up, you know, becoming depressed and being incredibly lonely. For those that really want to be in relationships and enjoy, you know, the pleasure of being in a relationship with someone, if you're highly avoidant, this can be incredibly painful. For others, it's that, you know, they go into the spirit of, I'll show you, you know, in this sort of this overcompensatory mode and, you know, are choosing partners and then becoming private eyes and, just not a great way to live, you know, where you're constantly having to watch and check and demand and ask for things, which ends up sabotaging relationships ultimately anyway, because it'll be a burden to the partner who may be innocent of all of this. So I think it's that, you know, finding that healthy adult part of ourselves that can be educated, knowledgeable, really wise, understand narcissism. If you're dealing with narcissists, I'm not talking about the, you know, someone who's had an affair in a relationship without narcissism. Many of them can heal, some can't, but it's so different than the complexity of dealing with narcissism because you've got someone who feels entitled to what they did. They have so much shame underneath, and the only way they can bury that shame deep is to overcompensate and act very entitled. They will say, I'm sorry, but that's about as much as you might get. You're not going to get true remorse or empathy or transformation, not without some incredible help, some incredible therapy going on. That's what's needed. So learn as much as you can, because that's how you begin to not only know what questions to ask and how to be able to be a good advocate for yourself, but it also emancipates you from these ideas that this is your fault. You know, as I will say to someone, they say, well, maybe if I could have just been a little bit this or that. And I'll say, you know what, let's go with that. So let's say, you know, right now your libido is not that strong. You're not at your ideal body weight. You're not feeling as good about yourself as you did maybe 10 years ago. And he's not happy about that. He's feeling less attracted to you. It happens. That's the only choice he could have made. That was it? That was the only option he had? He had no option to talk about it with you. Maybe he could get some help together. Maybe he could be supportive of you. Maybe you could still enjoy your intimate life while you're on a mission of, you know, working through things together. That was the only option he had? And I say the same thing to the narcissist when they're in my treatment room, when they start doing all the justifications and the defense for their self-righteous behaviors. Really? That was the only option you had? So you were really upset with her constantly yammering on about blah, 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 and making demands. The only option you had was to sleep with 100 prostitutes last year. True story.
Wow.
That was it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. So how would, you know, you brought up some really good things for somebody to kind of consider in any, you know, in terms of moving forward. Is there, you know, is there anything else that a person who's been through that? Because I, you know, you did mention that we're talking about the narcissistic hypersexualization, you know, and the betrayal that comes from that, because it's almost like a constant, repeated, almost like a machine gun of betrayals at you versus the maybe one-off, you know, your partner went and slept with somebody on a business trip, you know, in a conference or whatever that is. Are there differences for somebody that's experienced one or the other? Because like I said, we're talking about kind of, I would say we're classifying this as the extreme version of it because of the repetition and the, and like you said, the entitlement is so different than a person who, you know, has a few beers at the bar and meets up with some attractive woman again on a business conference and just has that moment of weakness, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, both can be equally painful, you know, even if it's a one-shot deal, but a lot of it has to do with the reaction and the response thereafter. I mean, it's certainly much more troubling to know that this is repetitious pattern that has been, maybe you find out has been going on for years and years and is happening on a pretty regular basis, as many people will share with me. That is just startling. But it can be equally painful even to find out that it was a one-off thing. And the response is, too bad. You know, I was drunk. Give it up. Get over it. It's not a big deal. It's not going to happen again. You know. So you're entitled to your pain. You know, you're entitled to your pain. You're entitled to your hurt. You're also entitled to know that it's not your fault and that you have the right to, you know, to remorse and empathy. And you may not get that from this individual if they happen to be narcissistic, but you need to get that. And even if it's coming from friends, people who love you and know you, and especially from you. You know, as I said to someone the other day, when we speak in an assertive way about ourselves, our rights, our needs, what's not acceptable, it's not so much always, especially when you're speaking to a narcissist, it's not about how they respond on the other side. It's about you standing there and having that little girl behind you going, oh, yay, somebody's standing up for me. Somebody's speaking out for me. Someone's doing it in a way that sounds so right, so honest, so true, not just yelling and screaming and complaining, but really standing up for me. And that's a shift already. That's a step towards transformation already.
Yeah, that gave me goosebumps right there because my therapist has said that to me and she's reminded me of that a few times. And, you know, for the metaphor for people, and if you, you know, don't see a therapist regularly, this might not land. But if you do, I imagine a lot of people have this feeling, which is to remember to take adult me, put myself in between little me behind me and whatever is up there in front of me and to remind, you know, remind her, the little girl behind me, that I got you. You know, mm-hmm. that you don't have to handle this anymore. This isn't, you know, this isn't an issue for you anymore. You get to be a child. I get to be the parent. I get to be the adult here. I get to stand in here and take care of you. Mm-hmm. And that's a power. That is a powerful thing to learn. You know, I think we've talked about this before. You know, one of the things that some of us have to do is we have to learn to be the parent that we never had. Mm-hmm. And that's a really hard thing to do. But once you do know how to step into that, you know, on a regular basis, it definitely helps you. With being able to, you know, to make those adult decisions, you know, can somebody be accountable for their choices and will I forgive them for that? Yeah. Yes or no, it's my choice to make that as well. But if that other person can't be accountable, it won't be accountable. I get to decide that that's enough for me and that's okay. And I wasn't being rejected. I'm making the choice myself as the adult person to no longer allow this in my life anymore. You know, and to be able to reframe the way we view what has happened to us through these experiences and, you know, easier said than done. I'm not going to sit here and act like I'm some sort of Jedi master about this. I just had moments yesterday where I had to, like, again, you know, kind of talk myself back in because it is easy for those old wounds and those old voices to come back of, you know, what did I ever do that was wrong? Why me? you know, was I really that bad? I mean, those were all things that were running through my head just yesterday, you know, in dealing with part, you know, some of my situation that I've got going on of, you know, after having gotten just one more blast in the face of complete entitlement and disregard and just like, you know, it's hard to turn that off sometimes. But, you know, the adult version said, you know, this is not about you. This has nothing to do with you. This is all about them. And, you know, whatever they do is not a reflection on who you are as a person. You didn't do anything wrong. You know, that just person that was just incapable of being able to give you back, you know, what it was that you needed, because they're only concerned about what they need for themselves, you know, and you can't fix that. So
that's beautiful. And that is the pathway to grief, because we have to grieve the loss and the pain and healing, you know, healing and moving on.
Yep. Well, Wendy, this has been another amazing hour with you and talking with you. Just, you're just so brilliant and so wise. And then you do such a good job of explaining this for people. I think that's why people really like listening to you and hearing what you have to say about this, because it's deeply compassionate, but direct and straightforward and informative. And, you know, you definitely understand that when we're speaking to those of us, you know, that have dealt with, you know, troubling pasts and wounds and stuff like that, the last thing we need really is to have somebody, you know, scolding us, you know, or talking about this in a way that again reinforces and furthers that shame. Because, you know, we talking about a topic that deals with sex, yeah, as embarrassing as it can be for some people to address and discuss, you know, which is maybe why some people don't even really broach this topic or even consider this, you know, and want to get healing with it, because it could be humiliating for some people. And you do such an amazing job of it. And so I'm really grateful to have you here and to talk with me about this today.
I'm so grateful. Thank you for those really lovely words. That's very kind of you. And it always feels when I'm sitting with you, it's so much more than an interview. It's such a wonderful dialogue, and you prompt so much of the thoughtfulness that goes into this dialogue. And I appreciate your courage and your candor. I think I've said it before, and your openness. I think that's probably incredibly meaningful to all of your listeners.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me again.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiquiricone.com, and there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quirconi, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.